The AgriHood is one approach to what I call kind of the local food movement. It's people trying to ensure the integrity of their food by getting your food from people they know. And you, as that neighborhood, have control over how it's produced.
Farm-to-table living, a neighborhood that would be based on community and doing life with people and wellness. And so I'm reading this description of this agri-community, and I look at my husband, and I'm like, we will live here.
We set out on a journey over 7,000 miles ago because we wanted to learn as much as we could about the AgriHood lifestyle. And what we quickly realized is why more and more people are choosing healthier and sustainable communities over traditional or conventional subdivisions.
The biggest difference would just be the sense of like-minded people. We all want our kids to be outside, fishing, climbing trees, you know, visiting with the animals, being in touch with reality, being in touch with nature, eating healthy food. I mean, there's really no comparison. There's nothing quite like what we're experiencing here.
You're dialed into the perfect podcast. This is AgriHood Radio. Everything you need to know about the farm-to-table lifestyle.
Hey, John, how are you today?
Very good, thank you.
So now you were at the University of Missouri for several years.
Yeah, I've retired from there. I still have professor emeritus status from the University of Missouri, but I retired there almost 20 years ago. So I've just continued to kind of do the work I was doing before and tried to remain active and continue to help people understand issues that are related to economic sustainability and sustainable agriculture and things of this nature.
So back in the day, I did a little history about your upbringing. You were brought up in Missouri in a time where there was no running water. Fact?
Right. And yeah, when I was a kid, we didn't have electricity, and of course, we didn't have running water. But that we had a well where you'd draw it up with a bucket. And I think it's sometime later in my grade school years, we got electricity, and then we were able to get, you know, running water, and we were able to put in a small grade A milking parlor and kind of come into the 20th century after a while. But when I started off, you know, they were still farming with horses where I was. Industrial agriculture at that time was the old steam engine that pulled the threshing machine. Everything else was done basically with horses.
You know, and that's what I wanted to invite you on this call today, because my wife and I sat down and we watched the documentary. You played a big part in that documentary, Sustainable, which is available on Netflix right now. And I really strongly say this and believe this. A person cannot watch that documentary and leave there the same as they sat down, because the knowledge you provide and the enlightening facts you provide people while they're watching that documentary raises their level of awareness. And now they can make, I believe, better choices. And your line that it got me, my eyes wide open, is that literally the food we're eating is making people sick.
Right. Right. And I think that's an important part for people to understand. What we did to the food system, we did with good intentions. And I didn't have time in the documentary to explain all this, but I went from the farm in Southwest Missouri to the University of Missouri, and eventually ended up with my doctorate degree in agricultural economics from the University of Missouri. And then I went out and worked in university and extension systems, and I promoted this idea of industrial agriculture, you know, specialized, standardized, consolidate into larger farms. You know, farmers tell farmers, you know, you're going to have to be prepared to get bigger, get out of agriculture. And the idea was we were going to make agriculture more efficient, and we were going to bring down the cost of food, and we were going to make good food affordable to everyone. Well, you know, I believe that for about the first half of my 30-year academic career, and then during the farm financial crisis of the 1980s for a variety of reasons I won't go into here, but, you know, the farmers that had been following the advice of we so-called experts ended up with a lot of debt at high interest rates, and they were losing their farms. And I could see the negative impact of that on family farms, and then rural communities that were withering and dying that depended upon those farm families. And then it was only then I began to see, you know, what we were doing to the land in terms of pollution and erosion and things of that nature. But anyway, the final part of was that turned me around was whenever I came to the realization that not only were we sacrificing all of that, but we were sacrificing it with no good result. We weren't preparing people that were hungry. Food's insecure, today than it was back in the 1960s. And the part that you mentioned, in the process of trying to make food cheap, we took out much of the nutrient value of the food, and we ended up with foods that are high in calories but lacking in essential nutrients. And that's what's making people sick. We have an epidemic of obesity and diabetes and high blood pressure, heart disease, and various cancers that are associated with American diet. And all of those have increased as we've industrialized the agricultural system and industrialized the whole food system.
Okay, and how many fingers can we point at Monsanto with that Roundup product, in your opinion?
Well, I think we need to look at corporations for what they are. Corporations, family corporations is like a family. You can express your social and ethical values through how you operate that family corporation. But when you're talking about a big corporation like Monsanto or Cargill or DuPont or Bayer or any of those corporations, they're created as economic organizations, and they have shareholders scattered all around the world, all different ages, all different values. The only thing they have in common is the desire to increase the value of their investment, to increase the profits of that corporation. That's what drives it. And that's what's driving Monsanto, and that's what's driving all the big agribusiness corporations today, is the pursuit of the economic bottom line. So Monsanto simply done whatever they needed to do or thought they needed to do to increase their profitability. They came out with them and the other chemical companies came out with the agricultural pesticides to begin with. And then they come out with genetically modified organisms saying, the pesticides aren't working or they're not going to be acceptable. They're dangerous. So we'll replace them with genetically modified organisms. And then they come out with Roundup, which they say, okay, we can genetically modify crops so that it won't die from Roundup and everything else will. As a result of that, then farmers across the United States and around the world adopted this technology primarily because it was so simple relative to other technologies that were available to control weeds. So we ended up then, with Roundup applied all over the country and around the world. And only, 20, 30 years later, then we find that it's classified as a probable carcinogen. But I think the motivation for Monsanto was always just to make money, and we shouldn't expect them to do anything else.
At the expense sometimes of a human being's livelihood or life. So that being said, I, as you may or may not know, my wife and I are looking for an agri-hood, an agri-community to raise our son in. And that's the whole premise of our project, agrihoodliving.com. And that is to raise awareness that if people want to look into alternatives that they feel are healthier lifestyle options, I think the agri-hood lifestyle is a great start, because we have seen quite a few properties around the country right now. And what it is, it has the clean pesticide-free food, even sometimes organic food, that neighbors, the community has access to. So if they want to be part of the whole chemical society, industrial agricultural world, this might be a good option. So what do you say to that? And what do you know at this point in your career that people might want to consider, encourage them to look more for organic or fresh raised food without the pesticides?
Right. Well, I think that's where more and more people are coming. You know, the organic growth in organic foods was growing at 20% per year during the 1990s and up until the recession of 2008, it was growing at a rate of about 20% per year. I mean, it was doubling every 3 or 4 years. And this was a reflection of people increasingly are understanding that there's something fundamentally wrong with the industrial food system, and they're looking for alternatives. So they look to organic. But when organic becomes so popular, and became profitable, then the mainstream markets, the big processors, begin to buy up the organic farms or take control of the larger organic farms to produce their products there. And then the wholesale distributors and various other people got involved in specifying the standards for organics or maintaining the standards for organics. And to make a long story short, we ended up where over half of the organic eggs are produced in large kind of confinement operations, and over half of the milk comes out of big factory farms that are dairy farms that are producing the milk. And now we've got approval of hydroponic production of vegetables, which means they're produced without any soil. And so you see now that people are losing confidence in what I call the industrial organic, and that's where they're looking for alternatives like you're talking about. Back then, the agri-hood is one approach to what I call kind of the local food movement. It's people trying to ensure the integrity of their food, the ecological, social integrity, as well as the health and the nutrient value, by getting your food from people they know. And in an agri-hood, what you're doing is you're living around the farm where you're trying to get as much as your food as you're possible produced, so you know specifically how it's produced. And you, as that neighborhood, have control over how it's produced, so you can specify that. But I think it's a part of this much bigger movement, which is a whole variety of ways that people are trying to reconnect with their particular farmer or a group of farmers within a local community or in a local area. And it's a means of trying to avoid the problems that we discussed, the health issues, environmental issues, and so on, that are associated with the industrial food system. And they're trying to find an alternative to that by creating local food systems. The whole movement comes under the umbrella of consumer sovereignty, which is strong in the international area. And the idea of consumer sovereignty starts out with everybody has a right to enough culturally appropriate, healthful food that's produced in sustainable ways to meet their basic needs. And they have a right to determine their own food system. So I think the agri-hood is a very logical response, and you know, I think it'll fit with people that are looking also trying to reconnect with other people within communities, as well as reconnect with the land, basically, through their farmer.
Spot on. 100% correct. You know, and this is coming from somebody who was part of the industrial agriculture world for so many years, and now, and then you kind of change your views. And then also you had a report where you made a case for multifunctional farms of the future, right?
Right. And I think that is the farms of the future because, you know, my professional opinion, I get accused once in a while of giving personal opinions, but I think my
especially if you're married.
My professional opinion is based on, you know, 30 years of academic experience and 20 years since of speaking and listening to people all over the country and around the world to a certain extent. And so, you know, that's where it comes from. You know, multifunctional farming to me is the farming of the future, because what we're doing today is simply not sustainable. And what I mean by multifunctional, it's a farm that isn't just about the economic bottom line. It isn't about making a living. It's a socially responsible, ecologically responsible kind of way of farming, and the function of the farm is not simply to produce food, but it's to maintain the productivity of the integrity of the natural ecosystem that on which its long run productivity depends. It's maintaining the health of the soil and regenerating the productivity, and it's also farming is about, you know, connecting with the food with the person that's eating it. It's producing good, wholesome, healthful food that will support, you know, healthy societies and humanity over the long run. If you go back and look at the foundations of organic farming, for example, it starts back in the early 1900s. They were talking about organic farming as being a commitment to permanent farming, sort of an ethical, moral commitment to the future of humanity. So that's what multifunctional is about. It's taking care of nature, preserving, restoring, regenerating natural resources. It's being responsible to society, being a responsible member of a community, and feeling a sense of obligation to take care of the soil and to produce healthy food for healthy people for all generations. So that's what multifunctional is. It says it's not just about a business. It's an ethical and moral way of life.
So now the next question becomes then, organic, local, and other high-quality foods, more times than not, as you know, carry higher price tags than conventional food. So how can we make good food affordable or accessible to people with limited incomes?
Right. I think that's an important part of it. In the process of, I talked about, of reducing, making food more affordable, reducing the cost of production. We did, in fact, reduce the cost of farm level production on food. But unfortunately, what happened in the process is the food processors and manufacturers used this as cheap raw material, and then they went into what's called value adding, but it's cost adding as well, the packaging, processing, transportation, advertising, and so all of those factors now have added cost to the total food that we're consuming at retail, to the point where consumers never really realized the benefit of the lower farm value. But that leaves us at a point where there's opportunity today. Only about 15% of what we spend on average for food in the grocery stores and restaurants actually goes to the farmer for what they pay for the food. 85% of it is for processing, advertising, transportation, packaging, things of that nature. By and large, it's all those things that make food more convenient. Gets it to the place you want. It puts it in a convenient form. They do pre-preparation and things of that nature. Now, if you have lower income, then you have to give up something. You can't have as much of everything, but I would argue you don't have to give up good food, because if you can get raw or minimally processed food, let's say, and if you end up paying twice as much for that food, that's twice as much as that 15% that's paid today for raw food on average, then you're up to like 30%. But if you can cut that 85% that's spent on average for convenience, for transportation, advertising, so on, by getting it local, getting it from your own farmer, if you can cut that in half, then you've saved more than enough on the packaging and processing and this sort of thing by preparing your own food from scratch, more than enough to offset the twice as much that you paid for the raw food to begin with. And in fact, in the example I give you, you'd end up paying about 70-75% as much for food, even though you're paying twice as much for the raw food, presumably that's produced by organic, sustainable, nutritious means. Now, that means that you have to have low-income people will have to, learn to select, and I think we need to focus on helping lower-income people learn to select good, healthful food, understand that the food they're eating is making them sick, and know how to prepare it. And then there's also the challenge of finding time to prepare the food. But I think in a lot of cases where low-income people are working two or three jobs just to try to get by, they'd be better off working less for pay and spending more time preparing your own food. Because a lot of low-income people may spend 20%, 30%, or 40% of their income for food, as opposed to the average of less than 10%. So they're spending a lot of money for food today. If they can cut out that processing, transportation, advertising, and then they can afford really good food, but they need to take the time to prepare it for themselves. And I think it's a good way to raise a family. I grew up learning how to cook with my mother at the old cook stove, and it's served me very well through my life. It was a way for her to raise kids, and it was a way for us to learn a useful skill.
How about that? And that was a time when there was no running water or electricity.
Right, and we cooked in a wood stove.
See?
I don't know how she ever did that, get the temperature just right
and
bake. Cooking on top and things of that nature.
So the question, John, becomes, aren't we going to have to depend on the large-scale or industrial factory farmers to feed the world?
Yeah, that's a common belief, a common myth that's promoted around. Now, contrary to popular belief, industrial agriculture doesn't feed the world. In fact, the United Nations reports, various reports that have been done over time, indicate that somewhere between 70-80% of the people in the world today are fed not by large industrial farms or the global food system. They're fed by small family farms that most of us would call subsistence farms. And also the research that's done in other areas of the world, particularly in Africa and South America and places like this, indicate that we could double or triple the yields on those small farms without using industrial agricultural practices, without making them significantly larger. And there's a whole global movement called agroecology, and it's kind of brings together the principles of ecology, working with nature, with the soil, with the water systems and things of that nature, and bringing it in into agriculture, and organic and sustainable and biodynamic and permaculture and nature farming and holistic resource management kind of all fall in this particular kind of category. And so these are the kind of farming systems that are being, implemented by small farmers around the world, and they're able to double or triple their yields when they do this. And so if they're producing 70-80% of the food for people today, if they double their yields, that's 140-150% of what's being produced today. We wouldn't even need industrial agriculture.
Love it.
And then those folks are beginning to understand that the Green Revolution didn't feed the hungry people. It increased production for export. But just like in this country, we're not feeding the hungry people in this country by the industrial agriculture. The production goes somewhere else. And they're also beginning to understand that the health issues that we've talked about here of obesity and diabetes and heart disease and things of this nature, wherever they take the industrial agriculture and the industrial food system, then you see a rise in those particular health issues as well. So they don't want industrial agriculture. They just need a little help, kind of like American farmers got in the early 1900s with the early work of the Extension Service and the experiment stations. They just need a little help in understanding agroecology and how to implement that on their own farms. And if we focused on that rather than trying to export our surpluses into countries that instead need to develop their own farmers, then the whole world would be far better off.
Well, that's well said, John. And the young people today, we kind of saw a trend where, as opportunities become greater. They were leaving the family farms, and you have quoted for greener pastures. How do we get the young people back on the farm?
Well, I think there's a lot of young people today that want to go back to farming. There's a lot of people, young people, that are interested in farming today. And I think the important part in talking to them and talking to other people is when we talk about sustainable agriculture, agroecology, holistic resource management, organic farming, and this sort of thing, we're not talking about going back to the drudgery of the farming as it was whenever I was growing up. When I was growing up, farming was hard physical labor. You get out and picked up hay bales by hand and threw them up on the wagon, put them in the barn by hand and things of that nature. We're not talking about going back to those times. There's all sorts of technologies today that are available on small-scale farms. They're well-developed, particularly in Europe and other places that have a lot more small farmers that take a lot of the drudgery out. When you see that in the United States, you see it more. I think one prime example is the low-cost solar-powered, highly mobile electric fences that farmers use on farms where you have grazing operations. And going to holistic resource management, for example, or management intensive grazing or planned grazing or systems like that, they develop these small paddocks where they move the cattle. You want to call mob grazing is large numbers of cattle from place to place where they get fresh grass all the time, and then they give the grass opportunities to regenerate. They can double yields or more on pastures just simply by using the simple low-cost technology of portable electric fences. And there's also kind of pull behind and walk behind small-scale equipment that take out much of the drudgery on vegetable production and things of this nature. So there's still some work involved, but it's not the drudgery in agriculture that was there before. And when we're talking about, the future, recreating the food system of the future, we're talking about, changing the technology development and research from just simply focusing on industrial technologies, which was the case in public research institutions during my professional career. We were focused on creating technologies that fit that industrial model that I described. It was well intended, but it was all focused toward trying to fit in with the specialized, standardized, large-scale farming operations. If we change the technology development to develop more and more technologies that are scale-appropriate that fit on farms, these smaller farms, then I think those kind of operations will become even less of the labor will be left there, and they will be more productive. But the most important thing, I think, is in the values of the young people that want to farm. We have an increasing number of young people that say, I don't want to get locked into even a high-paying job in an urban area where I'm going to spend my life doing what somebody else tells me to do, and I won't have a choice as to whether to continue to work there or quit because I'll have a big house payment, a big car payment, and I'll be kind of locked into this system where I have to earn more and more just to fit in the environment I'm in. We have people that say, I don't want to live that way. And they're saying, I want to be somewhere where I can be my own boss. I want to be outside in the open air. I want to raise my children on the place where I'm working so that I'm growing. They're growing up and they're growing up with me. And they see, you know, accurately, as I say, as an economist, that making money is just a means of doing something else. And if they can make enough money to farm, and that's really what they want to do with their life, then that's their goal. If they've got enough money to farm, then, you know, they've got enough money to live the life that they want to live. And I tell young people, I say, don't even think about farming as an occupation unless you think that's your calling, unless you think that's what you were really meant to do with your life. And it is, I think there's opportunities today that you can find opportunities to make enough money to live the life that you want to live if you're truly called to farm.
You know, what you're saying is everything we've been hearing about these agri-hoods, and that's what the new buyer, the younger generation is saying. Fortunately, there's big multi-million dollar development companies listening and accommodating that buyer today. The biggest buyer in America, largest group of buyers, is millennials. And they make up a good portion of the agri-hoods we've been looking at, not only as residents, John, but they're also most of the farmers that we've seen along our agri-hood tours are these people that you just explained. They want to, I mean, that's exactly what this agri-hood whole movement is about. Now, of course, you're going to have a multi-generational demographic, but the majority that we have seen, they started their research, building these agri-hoods based towards the new buyer, which is the millennials. And then they found out, wait a minute, there's more than millennials who are attracted to this lifestyle. There's a lot of people are attracted to, even baby boomers, retirees, everybody. So it's a great movement, great concept.
Yeah, I think the conferences that I have opportunities to speak at on sustainable agriculture, organic, and things of this nature, the most rewarding part about them is the diversity of the people that are there, young people, young families, but also older people, retired people, people in between. There's just the diversity of people that are beginning to wake up to the fact that there's something fundamentally wrong with our agriculture and with our food system. And they're kind of sharing ideas with each other and hopefully learning to work together and develop, caring, positive relationships. I think that'll be the key to success, is that we develop more caring, positive relationships with the earth and with each other. And that's going to require a diversity of people learning how to get along together and appreciate each other and to respect each other's views on things. And because nobody knows really how to do the things that we're talking about here. This is a major shift in the food system and a major shift within society. And so we're all just going to kind of feel our way through it together. For some of us older, we're not going to make it all the way through, but we're going to enjoy the ride while we're still here.
I tell you what you just left us with, though, John, is priceless. The knowledge you just shared in this few minutes we had time to spend together is something that, you know, whenever your time is to pass along, whatever you just left somebody else greater because of the wisdom you just shared. So I hope you recognize what you're doing is a great cause. And how can people get a hold of you? How can they find you? Do you have a website?
Yeah, I have a website, and it's just johneichard.com, johneichard.com. And if you go to that website, then you can find the contact information for me. It also has a link to my University of Missouri website that I still have up there where I post a lot of the presentation papers I make. And then I also have a Facebook page, and that's just, you go on and look for John Eichard, J-O-H-N-I-K-E-R-D, and you'll find my Facebook page there. So, I'm always glad to respond to, whatever I can, and I try to, post whatever information I think might be of use to people. And I appreciate you, passing along the idea that I'm may be helpful to somebody at some place, because that's my goal, is to really do whatever I can to contribute just a little bit to the greater good, which I think is what all of us are about.
Extremely obvious in your personality and your time you've shared with your generosities. How are you spending your days now that you're retired?
Well, since I've been retired in the last several years, I have an opportunity for about 20 to 25 speaking engagements a year that would require like an overnight stay or something. That's all I keep track of. I do quite a few things here locally that as well, but I'd have opportunities to go to different meetings. For example, in this last week on Monday night, I was speaking with a group in Iowa City called the 100 Grannies for a Livable Future, where they are involved in public issues, and I was talking on the implications of large-scale confinement animal feeding operations. And then right after that, I went to a suburb of Detroit, and it was a biosolids conference where you had people there that are in the state of Michigan that are involved in taking biological waste out of municipalities and trying to find ways to so that they can get that back on agricultural land, you know, in a way that's safe and remove the toxins and things of this nature, and whether it's through composting or various other means, trying to return that biological waste to the, you know, to the production system, much like they were talking about doing back in the early 1900s when a fellow by the name of Hiram King went to Japan and China, India, and Korea he went to. Wrote a book called Farmers of 40 Centuries. And one of the observations he had was in all of those places where farmers had farmed for 40 centuries without wearing out the land, that they would pile up the human waste, they call it night soil, in the streets and compost it, and they'd get it back to the land where the food was produced. So, you know, I never know from time to time, but you know, two or three of those a month, you know, keeps me busy. I prepare presentation papers, and then the things I do, I'm a member of the board of directors of the Jefferson County Farmers and Neighbors, which is a local organization that's committed to protecting our community from the threats of industrial agriculture, particularly CAFOs moving around in around us here in Iowa.
You're definitely keeping busy, and coming from me, somebody who does these interviews quite often, I see a little podcasting in your future, John. Have you thought about that?
I'd rather respond to what other people, you know, other people contact me, as long as they keep me busy doing that. I'd rather respond to the felt need of someone else rather than trying to create a particular thing for myself.
Well, you always have an opportunity here to share your wisdom with us, because we greatly appreciate it, especially in the process of our family trying to locate the perfect agri community for our family. Knowing what we know, having you reconfirm what we know, and the people who haven't heard about agri communities or agri hoods, hearing it come from a professional like yourself, it all is making sense. So please understand, we appreciate your knowledge, your time, your generosity, and we'd love to have you back on in the near future and talk more about it.
Okay, very good. I appreciate the opportunity to, you know, share my ideas for whatever they're worth with anybody. But I always appreciate the opportunity to share more broadly, so I appreciate the opportunity to be on your program and your podcast.
They're worth their weight in gold. Thank you again, John. We'll be in touch.
Okay, very good.
Thank you.
All the best.
All right,
bye
you
now.
Too. Bye-bye.
If healthy and sustainable living is important to you and your family, join the Coleman family as they travel the country and discover some of the best agri communities in America.